Welcome to the BMT Sustainability Podcast with me, Del Redvers, Sustainability Director at BMT.
And me, Laura Blake. As Head of Sustainability, I've supported BMT's sustainability agenda for 7 years and have dedicated my career to driving sustainable development and responsible business practices.
We have a shared interest in the complexity of shaping a better world. And together, this is our first experience of delivering a podcast.
We're super excited to give this a go and hugely appreciate you being with us on this journey, exploring the diverse and dynamic world of sustainability as we work to deliver purpose-led change.
Our world is full of complex and interconnected challenges, where it isn't always possible to reduce ideas to a single soundbite or statistic, and often where there isn't an objectively right or wrong answer. We want to talk to people across our business to get their ideas on sustainability-related topics, and in doing so, to improve our thinking as a business.
This podcast is our attempt to do just that. In each episode, we will explore different ways of looking at a wide range of challenging topics, prompting us to think critically and stay open to change.
So, thank you for listening, and let's get started. So today, our conversation is going to explore where we lead and where we follow with our customers. And welcome back. Thanks for joining us again for another podcast. We know that as in BMT, we have a really strong purpose to help navigate some of the most important and impactful engineering challenges of our time. And the biggest impacts we can have are achieved through the work we do for our customers, for the projects we do, like many organizations. And so to go further and faster, to rise to the challenges society's facing and the urgency of the climate crisis, how hard should we push our customers? Do we simply deliver whatever they want, or should we insist on more sustainable solutions? Where should we lead and where should we follow? To delve into this gray space with a lot of questions and perhaps not that many easy answers, we're delighted to be joined by Monty Long, who's here to help us understand and unpack all of these ideas. So, Monty, hello, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Del. I'm good and really excited to be here and having this conversation. Challenging subject.
Isn't it? So, look, tell us a little bit about you. Firstly, what is it? What's your job? What's your role? And then tell us a little bit perhaps about where your interest in sustainability comes from.
So currently I'm the Government and Industry Relations Director here in BMT. So bridging very much between the company and the clients in terms of what we do. I've grown in BMT from being in the future business as one of the business development team, business development director. So always been that interface between the company and the customer, representing and providing that voice into BMT, trying to help shape how we address those challenges that you opened up with them for the company. Why am I interested in this subject? Actually, it's a little bit obtuse. I started my career through the Royal Navy, and through that, you know, ended up being the customer, placing those demands upon industry. And actually, we were kind of mandating those standards, the standards in terms of how we do business, what we need for ships, what we need for our systems that are on the ships. And it was quite mechanical. It was all about the theoretical of how performance-wise. Actually, then I learned from listening to my children, there is a larger thing playing out here. It's a societal interest and where is society going? And my real passion and interest then came from actually supporting my daughter, who was doing a degree in sustainability and then going on to do a master's degree in as well of climate change. And learning from her and learning, supporting her readings in many ways about some of these broader aspects of how sustainability plays upon the totality of what we do in life. And then applying that back in my life in the Royal Navy and then extending that from my time in the Navy into my time into BMT.
So there's so much to draw on there, Monty. You're clearly the right person to be having this conversation with. And really value your experience of bringing, you know, the customer voice and making sure we understand that kind of customer perception. So look, a good place to start the conversation, I think, is with the idea of what customer service means. And I guess it can be interpreted in lots of different ways. But what do you think, Monty? What do you think customer service means to you? What comes to mind when you hear that term?
Well, in the most simple terms, you could apply it to life in McDonald's in terms of, you know, that front of house, that ability to give the customer a good experience in terms of what they need. That would be a very simple way of looking at it. But if you then come back to where we stand as a engineering and services provider into the MOD more broadly, it's our ability not just to deliver what the customer wants, but to go beyond what the customer wants, to make sure that we are shaping into the future in terms of setting standards, which we then maintain ourselves and actually help the customer to go further than they probably would do on their own.
Well, what do you think, Laura?
Yeah, I completely agree with Monty. I think traditionally when we think about customer service, we think about what a customer wants, but really it's also about understanding what they need, not just in the short term, but in building those longer term trusted relationships. Because often customers don't yet know what they need. And I think that's exactly where customer service and sustainability align.
Yeah, agreed, Laura. And I haven't been the customer. You think you know what you want, but you don't. And actually, the corporate knowledge of the MOD and the corporate knowledge of our clients more broadly, not just the UK MOD, is not always there. It's actually vested in the board of enterprise. And BMT and other companies, you know, other companies also allowed, are part of that corporate knowledge. It's how we as a group societally bring things along and develop things in terms of how we do it. Customer service at its worst, of course, is you just do what you're told and walk away. Now, you could turn around and say you've delighted because that could be what the customer wanted. But actually, with hindsight, you know, having a burger thrown in your face and then walking out, you may like your burger. That's not customer service. It's actually having that full experience of going in there, being able to engage and actually testing and adjusting when you're in there, you know, in terms of that service delivery to the needs of the person in front of you. But it's got to be done within a framework that works for both parties. And one party will always set that framework. And it's normally what I would call the service provider in terms of that. And that's where companies like BMT, you know, have to set those standards that they are responsive to the client and therefore can meet those client needs.
So is part of customer service, and if I'm hearing you correctly, part of customer service is having a real understanding of the customer, their needs and the problems that they're facing, which may sometimes exceed their own understanding of the problem.
Very much so. I couldn't put that in a better terms. We often understand the customers better than they understand themselves, mainly because a lot of our people and our experiences have been on the customer side of life. And we are that corporate knowledge that actually extends through. Yes.
Yeah. And there's a project I was involved with in BMT many, many years ago, and it was for the US Coast Guard. And it was on a decarbonisation project, working with a bunch of our colleagues in the States. And there was a scope of work we were responding to. And one of our colleagues had this passion to include sulfur emission reduction into the proposal we were putting forward to the customer. And the customer had a look at it and said, no, I don't want that bit about sulfur emissions. This is about carbon emissions. I'm not interested in sulfur emissions. So they bounced it back. And they also asked for some adjustments on other things and pricing and so on. And then the proposal went back to them, but the section on sulfur emissions was left in because the person involved was adamant that it was what the customer really needed. And the customer threw a bit of a fit and said, no, I told you once, I don't want it. I'm not paying for it. Take it out. And it got knocked back again. And so then it got added in as a freebie, and the cost was taken out, but the work was left in. And the customer came back and said, well, if you can afford to do it, take it out and take the cost down. I don't want it. Why aren't you listening? And I thought it was a really interesting exploration of that boundary between listening to the customer and also the kind of the potential arrogance that I think sometimes exists in consulting organizations where we think we know better than the customer. With all of your experience, Monty, how do we walk that line? How do we get that balance right?
That is the ultimate challenge. Okay, so you've got to know your customers to know where those boundaries lie. The customer is always right, and we've got to remember that. But actually, we also need to be able to direct and move that customer along in terms of that journey. We, as a company, have to set our own standards and live by our standards. The customer's needs have to be met. If they're going to push back on someone and say it costs more and all the rest of it, we have to challenge ourselves saying, is it costing more? Well, if it is, then we bake it into how we cost and do our proposals and bits and pieces like that. But if it's part of what we do and what we believe in, then so be it. You know, that is part of the cost of doing business with BMT, is the fact that we want to be seen to be sustainable. Now, that kind of challenge and that extra thing back onto the customer ultimately sets us apart and gives us a differential in terms of what we're doing. So meeting the immediacy will give us that short-term money in, but it's not going to set the conditions for long-term growth and long-term success. That's where we need to invest into the future and having standards which go far and beyond what they need now. Because here and now, it will give you money today. It will set the conditions for you to have a good financial year this year, but it won't set the conditions for you to have long-term success and long-term growth because you haven't got a market differential and you're not, you haven't got something which ultimately sets you apart from the rest. And that's what we need to do if we're going to have that constant aspiration in order to grow. But that also implies as well, if you want to have a constant market differential, we also need to be continually evolving, continually staying at the cutting edge and continually setting our standards above the rest of the marketplace in order to be that aspiration about where other people want to go. And the secondary benefit is not just the customer. The secondary benefit is internal. It's very much aimed at where our people want to be, where our people want to work, recruiting, retention, and all the other bits and pieces. And actually, you know, people thinking, you know, people want to think differently. People want to think about how to push the boundaries. We've got engineers. They like new challenges. So giving them the opportunity to think further ahead is all part of how we have to do business inside BMT. Now, you could think I'm talking about an engineering challenge, but I'm not. That applies across all of our themes in BMT, from sustainability through to engineering through to technology.
And at the heart of what you're saying, I think, Monty, is that we have to use our understanding and our knowledge of a customer and the problem in the industry to see how we can genuinely create value. And if we can genuinely create value, we have to communicate that value to a customer in the way that they understand. And that gives us the license to do it. But the essence of it is to actually create the value. If we're confident we are really creating value for customers, then we have somehow got the license to push and drive and encourage them to see and understand that value creation and perhaps go further than they otherwise would.
Yes, an individual value for a client would often be measured in, can you meet the KPIs of this particular, you know, contract? Are we delivering to, you know, what we've been set to do? The value we're talking about here is probably a lot more ethereal than that. It's the value that we set on ourselves about where we want to get to and all the rest of it. So the value proposition that we're talking about here is not a client-related one. It's probably what we want to do more broadly. It's our advocacy. It's where we sit in terms of trying to take our company and our personal positions beyond the day-to-day of what we're doing today. I think it's a danger if we talk about pure value in the sense that you opened up, that we're talking about a contract value of delivering today. Anybody can do that. That's not what we want to do. We want to deliver more than that. So you could say it's value, but the company, we can put credence on that ourselves, but the client won't necessarily do that. But it does help us in the longer term.
I think it's a really healthy way of looking at it and very helpful. What do you think, Laura?
What I find challenging here is the tension between our values as an organisation and the reality that some customers may not align with them. So there's a point, isn't there, where we have to be clear. If a client's direction pushes beyond what we believe in, BMT can and should say no. And that's where we can genuinely differentiate ourselves. But the complexity really comes in because we operate across different markets. So some are further ahead on their sustainability journey than others. And the truth is that we profit from both. So there's this broader question, does working in one market give us the flexibility to take more risk or do more ambitious work in another? So it's easy to say on paper that we can walk away from misaligned work, but in practice, where you're in a market that isn't progressing in the same way, can we always afford to take that position as a business?
But I think what you're saying here almost is, can you have a common set of standards that apply across all our markets? Can you have a common set of standards that apply across all of our geographic regions? And we've got geographic regions in BMT that are very different, come different political backgrounds, different stances on bits and pieces. And we have to apply and appeal to them all if we're going to be successful. So what you need and what we have to work on, and we have created, is a set of values which exist and can be applied across all of our markets and applied across all of our geographies. They then have got to have a flexibility to be able to move within them. So you have a corporate set of values in terms of how we work, which then have to be applied locally. But we should not deviate from what we've set in terms of that corporate framework. So that framework needs to be just robust enough to actually set us something that we all live to, regardless of our markets. But then within it, if you're working in defence in the UK versus working in environment in Australia, there may be different levels of which you can then drive down to within that. But I still think you need an overarching framework which we across the whole of BMT live towards.
So to make it, I guess, more practical in application then, when we're facing a piece of work from a customer and we can see a more sustainable solution or a more sustainable way of going about it than perhaps they've asked for or specified, when should we push? How hard, how far should we push? How do we do that?
The only way to do that is through customer intimacy. We need to know and understand our customers. Bidding blind, taking something off a framework and we're just throwing a solution, you are going to get it wrong. What we need to, if we know them well enough, then we can take them on that journey with us. And it comes back to what we were talking about before, about having a longer term vision that we're trying to tell the customer, you can get to here and here is part of that. The secondary benefit for me in the future business community is that leads to follow-on activity and follow-on contracts, because what we're then doing is actually building a journey with the customer, and actually he will come back to us to take him on that journey. If we get it wrong, if we just deliver what they've asked today, the chances are that then they've delivered, they're happy and they walk away. But if we can sell something in terms of a vision, then, and sustainability is that vision, then they will continue with us on that journey. And actually, it feeds into our bottom line at the end of the day, because it's repeat business and good work. So setting a vision with the client about what they can do is really good for business.
And how should we feel about being the pushy consultant that's always upselling in that context?
Happy. In all honesty, you know, a pushy consultancy is, again, I've been the client. I've seen pushy consultancies at work. A pushy consultancy is not one that, you know, stretches you and challenges your vision. A pushy consultancy is the one that goes to the toolbox and opens up the same toolbox and sells you the same thing several times over. They are just rinsing, repeating. That's the pushy consultant. A challenging consultancy, a pushing consultant, from that point of view, is one that takes you and the vision and helps you articulate a vision. Now, if your vision aligns with the consultancy, great. It gives you longer duration and a great relationship to build and work from. I think the worst thing you can do is just resell the same old thing to a different client.
And do you think, I mean, in BMT, we talk about our independence as being something that somehow has a bearing on our ability to give impartial or unbiased support or advice or something like that. What's your view of independence? Does that help us to drive to a more purpose-driven outcome?
I think the word independence, to be quite honest, is something that we use to get to the real term that matters for BMT, which is the word trusted. Ultimately, our clients trust BMT in terms of how we do it. Now, independence is part of it in terms of our impartiality and in terms of how we can work both as customer friend and supplier, industry side, government side, all at the same time, because we are trusted. Our ability to partition ourselves, to share knowledge in a practical yet safe way, means we are trusted. Now, the independent side of life and our ability to look across the marketplace in terms of solutions and offering back, you know, it is fantastic. But trusted is the key word for me.
And trusted to do what? Or to be what?
Trusted, inverted commas, to give the best advice in the most impartial manner. And actually, it comes back to when we talk about sustainability-wise, is looking into the future and giving them a view of how to get to the future. So we are often used to write requirements, to set specifications. And these are for equipment that are in service for 15, 20, 50 years. You know, the carrier. Carrier BMT wrote the UK carrier, the Queen Elizabeth class. BMT wrote the requirements. BMT helped do the design. Okay. That carrier will now be in service for 50 years. Now, you can't tell me that we didn't have to think what the world was going to be like in 50 years' time in terms of operating, but that operating is not just the fighting zone, it was also all the environmental side of life around that, and putting in there the standards and the options and the ability to see where we're going with future fuels, for example, is a key part of what we do in any of our platform design activity.
And so building on that idea then, I really like this idea of trust, being trusted, and it's something I know we talk about in the business quite a lot, and we value these trusted relationships we have with our customers. I want to take it onto a topic that I know, Laura, you're really passionate about, which is the kind of moral side of the interaction we have. And if we are in trusted relationships with our customers, and I think we are in many places, and we have privileged access to our customer relationships, and we have insight that can help our customers go further and succeed by whatever criteria you want to call that, in the world, do we have a moral responsibility to push that, to make that happen?
We do. And I thought it was a really relevant example, designing a platform to last 15 years, because that's where we have a responsibility to ask the right questions and help our customers prepare for a very different future. Of course, we can make differences through services like environmental impact assessments, evaluating materials or assessing operational emissions, but real value comes when we go beyond business as usual. And this is where our moral responsibility often sits. And it's remembering it's not just about a moral imperative, it's a business one. I rarely see a conflict between doing what's right and what a customer needs. In fact, when we talk about sustainability and purpose-driven business, the real cost comes from not acting. And we also know from sustainability, we can't take the social and environmental pillar away from the economic pillar. There's just not a world in which we live in and that happens. So we talk about bottom line and organisations profiting and different markets, regulations and all this stuff. But at the cusp of all of this is a world with a finite amount of resources. And I think that's the reality underpinning every market, regulation and profit model. So yes, we can talk about responsibility and morals, but those conversations are also about resilience, growth, long-term profit. And I wouldn't separate the two. I think they go hand in hand.
It does, yeah. And would you agree with that, Monty? How would you see our moral responsibility?
Well, I do. Now, I completely agree with what Laura said, because it comes back to the final point you mentioned there. You know, we are setting, you know, standards that other people aspire to. So actually, by us staying, you know, looking further ahead, being more forward thinking in terms of where we are as a company, we're becoming aspirational. We're not just aspirational internally, we're aspirational externally. We've become an advocate, and we don't have to be an extremist to be an advocate. You just need to be taking people on that journey. And if we can set our own standards there, then we become something that people aspire to become. And for me, it's good for business. It's good for making the money, because people come to us for our contracts and bits and pieces. But we're actually doing it for the right reasons. It's not a money thing. It's actually a benefit to us. And the money that comes in for the site is almost a side benefit, if you know what I mean. But, you know, we've got to forget what we're here for. And sustainability is therefore not a side. It's a core part of how we do it and how we grow. It's part of our overarching strategy for growth.
So I want to bring this back to kind of the practical application then. And we're saying that we think there is a moral responsibility to help our customers be prepared for the future. And we're also saying that actually that we should do that in a way that creates benefit for the customer and helps them into the future. Do we think then that we have a duty on pretty much every project we do to push for more sustainable solutions where we can see that?
I think it goes back to what Monty said earlier. It's really about knowing your customer. It's not just about offering a sustainable solution, but understanding where the customer is in terms of being ready to embed that solution and to build on it. We can help our customers on their decarbonisation journey, but if they don't have a wider sustainability strategy, then maybe that could only get them so far. That said, I don't think it always has to be about the whole organisation. I think some of our customers deliver one-off projects that have a huge contribution over the project life cycle. And sometimes I think those projects are, in fact, the strategy. So in answer to your question, Dale, yes, I think we have a responsibility to push for better, but I think we have to tailor that to the context. Are we helping them become a better business overall, or are we contributing to something meaningful within the scope of a project? That's where I think our moral responsibility sits, in how we frame what we're delivering and how we help them to go further, even if it's one step at a time.
I think you have to, again, knowing the customer, challenge back where appropriate, to be quite honest. And I think we should be, in our physical solutions, you know, offering them choices as we go through. And I'll come back to something as basic as ship design, giving them the choice and of the fuel systems and the option to change in the future, giving them injection points in terms of a life cycle platform about when and how you could transfer your fuel systems or whatever like that is key. Into the consulting offer in terms of what we do. You know, we management consultancy, doing project and program management, just giving them the basics of, you know, this is how you're doing it, this is what you've asked for, but ... You know, having that ability to have the ... question and then bring in the alternatives and potential better ways of doing it. And, you know, I say better ways in terms of whether it's a footprint, emissions footprint, or whether it's simply, you know, looking to the future of where their work could take them and the direction of travel they've set themselves. Knowing your customers well enough to then have that and say, and this is the impact of, doesn't take much from us. It's an extra 2 or 3%, but it marks us out from the crowd in terms of making sure that the customer is educated about the choices and the direction of travel. But that means our people, everybody, needs to understand that ourselves implicitly in terms of how we do it and be willing to give that 2 or 3% difference from our competitors in terms of taking that customer on that journey. So we've got to be all educated, you know, on what that 2 or 3% would mean externally, as well as what it means to us internally within BMT.
Yeah, I think that's a really important enabler behind that, that we can't forget that we have to enable ourselves, our organisation, to be prepared to be able to do that.
I mean, you can't do that with experts. Yeah. You've got to, it's the whole, we've all got to understand that. And it comes back to, we said, that framework of what we, BMT Enterprise, BMT individuals that make up the enterprise, believe in and understand, you know, our purpose to be.
Entirely. So in the same way, is there a parallel here that we sit in a supply chain, and we have suppliers below us and we have customers above us. And every time we procure something out of the supply chain, we have an opportunity to send a signal into the market. And we ask our suppliers, as I hope most companies do, we ask them about slavery, and we ask them about ethics, and we ask them maybe about their carbon. And that gives us an opportunity just to put a little influence in by asking the question. It sends a signal into the market that customers are interested. Should we always be sending that signal up the chain as well, by always presenting that option, that idea, that dynamic? Whenever you engage with BMT, you're going to get a little push about sustainability.
In my humble opinion, I don't think that will do any harm whatsoever. I think what do we make sure that it sits within that, again, come back to the purpose statement of what we believe in, what we want to do, where we want to make a difference for ourselves. So it becomes a differentiator. I think your hardest point is actually into the supply chain. You know, but you know, the whole point about a supply chain is they've got to, in the same way as we're part of the supply chain to our customers, you know, looking the other way, we've got to be able to extend those values and virtues downwards. So we should demand of the people that are in our supply chain as the same standards that we're supplying upwards into our end customers. So you know, there is effort there. There is effort required in order to check, in order to actually make these things happen. But if we look at what we're promising to deliver, and actually some of it is now being contracted through the social value statements that actually are part of our contracts and contract scoring, then we've got to ensure that that happens. So we have to invest in that supply chain check, and we've got to invest in making sure that we deliver ourselves what we say to the customer.
That makes complete sense. I want to go back to something you said, which I really liked a moment ago. No, I loved it. And I think I completely agree with it. You said you don't have to be an extremist to be an advocate, which I think is a great phrase. So in the scope of the world we operate in, what do you think advocacy means?
Well, to me, advocacy is pushing an agenda beyond the norms that we are today. Now, it could be, you know, it doesn't have to be an extremist. But, you know, trying to change either the policy or anything as softer as just the political views of an organisation is advocacy for a subject. It's just moving an agenda forward. Different ways of doing it, of course. You know, you can do it through hard action, through changing policies. You could do it through publicity, whether that's social media or conversational. You know, the podcast kind of approach that you're doing here in many ways is advocacy in trying to push forward the agenda of what we in BMT believe in terms of trying to move the needle. I think advocacy, has its extremes, and the extremes are, you know, hanging yourself off a bridge with a banner, lying in the road and, you know, super gluing yourself. But also it means being able to engage, have a conversation, and just challenge the status quo. Anything that challenges the status quo and moves things along, to me, on a journey, is advocacy.
And have you brought your super glue with you today?
I haven't, but I have some chains.
Well, what you do in your personal life is up to you, Monty.
Look, when I think about advocacy, I think about looking beyond your own interests as an organisation. And I think a really good example of this could be Dell Technologies. I know a few years ago, they started to think about tackling ocean plastics, and not just by how they use ocean plastics in packaging, which I think they were one of the first to do, but by looking at how they go further than that and how they get involved in shaping policy, raising awareness and bringing other stakeholders on that journey. And I think it's all those things that Monty just alluded to. And I think that's the bit that really stands out for me. Advocacy isn't just about solving the problems for your business. It's about how you use your influence to drive that wider change that's required.
And so that comes back to the point about standards as well, doesn't it? About raising the bar, raising the standards. And something we haven't touched on so far is there's kind of pushing, advocating with individual customers. But then there's the role for an organisation like BMT to do that at industry-wide level or in particular markets.
And this is where Sarah's fantastic engagement across the broader sectors as a whole, the industry, government industry body she sits upon in terms of pushing that into the policy space. But as I say, that's just one part of how you move an agenda along as a nation. And you can hit policy, but actually influencing from the bottom up, the people movement side of life that influences policy is as powerful as it is one or two individuals doing it. I love the Patagonia example. You know, Patagonia moving the world along in terms of its sustainability agenda. Great kit, really expensive, but what they're doing is fantastic. But actually, you know, they're not able to move the whole of the buyers along on that journey. But the buyers individually getting together across the world, as they do in their groups, will have more of an impact. Yes, they will refer to Patagonia. And we'll refer to them as, look, here's a great example of a company. They're the ones that are actually making the real change. Patagonia, an example that others can follow, but their advocates are the smaller groups around the world that get together and look at Patagonia in terms of dragging people into that space. So the power of the masses is what then points people at those one or two leading pillars. So, yeah, we all proudly wear our Patagonia coats. Why do I wear it? Not necessarily because of sustainability. It's just the best kit, you know, and the sustainability aspect is as a secondary benefit.
It was interesting over the last year to observe organisations attempting to be seen like Patagonia as more socially and environmentally conscious. We observed fast fashion markets increasingly use terminology like conscious consumer or environmentally friendly, like in our previous podcast. And I think now people have started to realise that these fast fashion markets aren't really moving the dial at all. And it's as if they were trying to follow, but it's resulted in them being even further behind because they hadn't really embraced what Patagonia was all about in terms of their business model. And I don't think they had fundamentally understood the sustainability standards that they were adhering to, or at least the purpose of those standards. And then I think on the other side, we saw Patagonia lead in this space through campaigns such as the one where they told consumers not to buy a t-shirt. They absolutely told their market that the best thing to do was not buy fashion. And I think it's because they'd grasped the negative impacts associated with the industry.
Now, there's a whole other podcast we're on the realms of getting into here, because this is a really interesting topic. But there's a really interesting thing here, and I don't want to go too far off piece. With companies like Patagonia Tony's Chocolonely is another example of a company, a chocolate firm, who have positioned sustainability at the centre of their brand. And they've both come under fire. Both those companies have come under fire because of what happens when you attempt to make your product vastly scalable and accessible. And so you can create the perfect product, a bit like we could in DMT. We could create the perfect sustainable solution, but it's an inaccessible solution to the customer. And therefore, actually, it has no real application and it's not very useful. It's idealistic, but it's not very useful. With companies that are trying to make, you know, these companies that are trying to develop sustainable solutions for the consumer market, they make great ideas and products. When they try and scale it so it's in every shop on every high street and you can get to it, you can't do it at that perfect level of sustainability anymore.
No, but the whole world has moved along. Patagonia, being one great example on the far left-hand side of the chart of this is where you can get to, haven't they dragged everybody else up a little bit? So the masses have moved up because of one example. So you always need those big examples, but you need to be able to move everybody up. And that's where the real benefit comes, is adding the volume. So everybody moving a little bit is better than one person getting to the extreme.
Completely right. I couldn't agree more. And I think that's really important for companies like us as well, which is that we have to push for more sustainable solutions with our customers. We have to help them. But the goal isn't perfection. The goal is just making steps and helping advance the discussion and the agenda and enabling our customers to go that way.
And enabling the customers is not always giving them the answer now. It's showing them where they could be in the future and giving them those choices. It comes back to what we're saying about, you know, demonstrating where they could be. It comes back to the carrier conversation earlier. Demonstrating what you could be, not doing it now, but giving them the ability to do it in the future. Don't close options out. That's the key point for us in our solution space. Don't close options out. Give them choices and show them what those choices could mean for them.
Now, I want to move into a slightly different area of this conversation, which is it's not about how do we push the customer to develop more sustainable solutions, but when we think about the delivery of a project or a program. So we know what we're trying to design or advise on or develop or whatever it might be. We know what the project is. But if a customer asked us to do something that we felt endangered the safety or the well-being of our employees or other people, I think we would hopefully be quite ready to say, stop, this doesn't feel safe. Equally, perhaps, if we felt the approach a customer was taking to a particular project or a way of working, we felt conflicted with our views about diversity and inclusivity, if it was prejudicial to certain sections of society, the approach they were taking or the way they wanted to work. Again, I hope we would feel as an organization, we would say, I'm sorry, stop, that's not right for the way we want to work. Do you think we have that same mindset in terms of when a customer says delivery is going to look like this, that we say, stop. That is not a particularly climate conscious way of delivering this program or project, and we think there should be a better way. We're not happy with, let's just keep it in simple in one dimension of climate change. We're not happy with the impacts of your proposed method of delivery.
I hope so. I truly hope so, because isn't that all part of the same moral framework as health and safety? You know, it's, we've set the standards that we believe in. If we're not going to deliver and live to the standards that we set, and we say we're going to do in terms of our global policies and frameworks, then we haven't got global policies and frameworks. So I almost the question doesn't compute for me, Del, because we should be. And if we're not, then we're not doing what we said we're going to do in the first place. And that comes back to our credibility and our trust. And if we've said we're going to do this, then we do it. And if we don't, then we're breaking that trust contract, not just with the clients, but with ourselves and our employees. So I hope so.
I think we like to think we do. But the problem is that we're not as consistent with sustainability as we are with health and safety. With health and safety, we carry out risk assessments to adapt to various global contexts, and they help us manage those more specific hazards in a structured and consistent way. But with sustainability, we often have the right mindset and we want to do the right thing, but I don't think we always have the tools or the shared experience to necessarily back that up. And I sometimes think that's maybe because we're confident in our environmental expertise and there's a potential risk that we assume that that's enough. But knowing the science isn't necessarily the same as navigating global trade-offs like supply chain ethics and social equity and so forth. And I think that's why risk assessments alone aren't enough in this space. Sustainability requires judgment and a framework for balancing those trade-offs. And there are recognised sustainability standards like GRI or perhaps SASB that could potentially help us to provide more of a framework. And they could show that we've fully thought through the impact of how we deliver a project. And then maybe that gives us the credibility to then challenge clients when their methods don't necessarily align with our values.
We're coming back as well to that conversation earlier about BMT is a global company and how it, you know, works, different markets, different geographies. Do we not have to set what we believe in and what we live at a corporate level, which then can be applied, you know, in the different markets? And it will be subtly differently applied in different markets. It'll be applied in different geographies. Health and safety standards here are very different than in Australia, for example. We don't often have to face alligators and crocodiles when we go to our daily jobs here, but some of the teams do in Australia in terms of how they work, and they have to deal with that. And the same with the sustainability. But you know, we have to believe in something corporately, you know, in terms of where we're going to. Now, I don't think there is a sustainability checklist in inverted commas at the moment. Could that be introduced, you know, in terms of how we do business contract by contract?
I think the point you made earlier about enabling our people and helping our people learn and understand, and that being such a vital enabler of being able to deliver change for customers, it also applies here. So absolutely, I think we need the right frameworks and checklists and things in place, but we also need to enable our people to recognise and think about some of these issues and know them when they see them.
I think that's an excellent point. What I wouldn't want to go down, and this is where we need to be careful of, is the health and safety checklist side of life, where sometimes it's not necessarily seen as protecting the individual, it's protecting the business. Actually, we don't want to go down that, but actually we need to be able to put something in place, inverted commas, that is, I don't want to say it, but it is. It's almost like that moral compass. What do we believe in? You know, can we check ourselves against, you know, the value statement that we put out at the front end of everything? You know, contracts, should our bids always start with this is our value statement? You know, would that be something, and then check that we're actually delivering against those values? ?
Great question. And I think bringing it back to where we bring challenge, I think it's important that we recognize our duty and our obligation when we look at the way a project is going to be delivered, to bring that same challenge and that same question. So in the same way we think about right at the beginning of our conversation, we said, well, what is customer service? Well, customer service is understanding the customer organization, understanding the customer need, and helping them get towards the most beneficial solution. And in the same way with delivery, we have to help get to the most beneficial way of delivering a piece of work. And I think there are things we set up, like a customer might, without thinking about it, ask for in-person presence on some sort of basis, which may not really be needed. And it's tempting to just say, well, this is what the customer asked. The customer is right. Therefore, that's what we're going to do. But there might be opportunity at that early stage to push back. Say, does it really need to be in person and in that frequency and with all of these people? Or is there a better way of doing it? Or we had that chat, Laura, with Simon Wilmore when we were talking about artificial intelligence and some of the impacts and how easy it is to say, well, let's just run the model again, or let's run a slightly, you know, different version of that model. And that feels like a really easy thing to do without thinking about actually how that contributes to the energy consumption or the cloud computing and the cost of doing that. And then perhaps we have to have it more in our consciousness to say, well, hang on, maybe we don't run that again unless we need to, or we get it right the first time with, in terms of the parameters we want to use.
Yeah, I definitely agree that there are places we could be more proactive in terms of challenging our customers. I wonder whether another helpful way of looking at this is thinking about how we would respond if the customer is further in their thinking than us and wants us to adapt our services.
What a wonderful problem to have. Genuinely, you know, our ability to learn ourselves from our clients is a key part of what we do. So if we've got a client that's going to challenge us, I'd love that we could actually embrace that. But it also comes back to the honesty side of life. If we're going to be honest integrity with their integrity and trusted, then, you know, can we honestly deliver to their expectations? Can we partner with somebody? You know, it's us be able to partner and learn and how to work with other people in terms of taking us on that journey as well. Hasn't happened yet that I'm aware of, but it could, Laura.
Well, I think innovation is a really interesting space for that to happen. Yeah. Because however much we see, however much we know, and however much we understand, we will only ever have part of the solution. And our customers and other stakeholders will have other parts of that solution. And I think we've talked about this before, but I think that we spend too much time innovating internally and not enough time facing into customer organizations and working collaboratively. And I know we're doing more and more of that, but that's a great space where there's opportunity to co-create and learn alongside our customers, where they bring a dimension and we bring a dimension, and together we can push forward a shared agenda.
I think that that's true. The challenge for that is in the business sense of, you know, we have to cost activity. And innovation and costing innovation when it's open-ended and you don't know the path to it, there's an element of risk involved in that in terms of costing activity. And in this cost-conscious world, when you're dealing and putting out contracts out the door and how you bid for stuff, that is a challenge to actually how you do that. You know, what you bake in for innovation, what you bake in for exploration, let's put it like that, because, you know, innovation doesn't always work, so it becomes exploration at that point, as long as you learn from it. But trying to cost that and then bake that into something that goes out the door in a very competitive world is tough.
It's quite a challenge, Monty. That's quite a challenge. So look, we're coming towards the end of a conversation. What haven't we touched on? Are there any other aspects here that we haven't looked into yet?
So we've touched on those aspects in terms of cost and innovation. But fundamentally, I think if you want to move the dial on sustainability, you have to embed it into your corporate purpose and your culture. And that's the kind of shift that takes time, it takes resource, it takes leadership. So we've talked about future work and engaging customers, but also recognizing that none of that's sustainable unless we are truly living our purpose. So I think the real challenge is, how do we continue to shift mindsets? How do we justify investment, especially at times when profit margins are tight? How do you lead on sustainability when your resources are limited? I think that's the barrier we haven't potentially fully addressed.
No, I think that's excellent. Yeah, you know, my following point from that is, you know, what levers can we then pull in the marketplace to be seen as leaders? So we've got that internal challenge that Laura's just mentioned there, but, you know, how are we addressing the external challenges of thought leadership, media presence, partnerships, in terms of how we portray ourselves in partnerships, and then leading back into that internal leadership and culture. How do we change the totality of what we do? We can do it through policies, but we actually have to do it through behaviours as much as anything else. So behaviours internally becomes one matter. And my question back to you both is, how do we then take those internal behavioural changes and actually make sure that others perceive BMT as a leader in this side of life, driven by own internal behavioural side of life? I haven't got the solution to that. And, you know, this is where I need help, because, of course, that helps me win work. That helps us, you know, have that long-term side of life. So what more can we be seen to be doing to be leaders in this space?
We had a really interesting discussion on this yesterday, and we talked to one of our teams about net zero targets. And for me, I think it's about getting people to understand the importance of them and setting high standards of ourselves. I think whilst we're a professional services company, ultimately our impact in the world, when you look at our operations, is small. But if we can demonstrate that we care and that we live our values, it gives us the license to be able to do everything else. And then naturally, we go and talk to our customers, and this is front of mind, because that's who we are, that's what we believe, and we've got ambitious targets which can support us to lead in this space. So I think we need to be talking more about them and our journey in terms of how we get there, because it gives us the license to lead with our customers. But I also think it's about being seen as a leader in the space, and I do think we need to be more visible. It's not just about living our values, it's about how we tell that story through the work that we go after, but also who we choose to partner with. And I think we need to be clear about the value we bring, and that's probably what we need to build on.
And I think there's that balance we've talked about here about being the Patagonia, or just being ahead of the pack and actually delivering it in something which others can actually live and follow and breathe to. I think there are elements of the business that needs to be the Patagonia, but I think there are also elements of the business that just actually bring you up everybody at the same time is actually even more powerful. So I think the two need to be in balance.
I think that's a brilliant place to round off the conversation, because I can't think of a better point to make to close that out. I completely agree. We've had quite a wide-ranging discussion around what leadership with our customers looks like. We've explored the idea of pushing our customers to achieve more, to go further, where it's beneficial to do that, about using our position, leveraging our position in those trusted relationships to do what we believe is right, but also how it's important to have that customer intimacy that you talk about so passionately, Monty, and really understand their needs and be able to respond to it in the right kind of way. And we've talked about the moral dimension of it as well, about how do we make sure that we're fulfilling our kind of moral obligation, both in terms of the extent to which we want to push, the extent to which we help our customers shape a better future, and the way in which we go about delivering projects with our customers, and having the voice and the right and the freedom to bring challenge to help shape a better future. We can do it. And all of that throughout our conversation, I've loved the constant reference back to purpose, really coming back to the idea of what it means to be a purpose-led organization. So thank you so much, Monty. You have brought a huge amount of light and insight to a very grey and confused area. Really appreciate you being part of the conversation. Have you enjoyed the discussion?
Thank you, Dale. It's been great fun. And yeah,
thank you, Monty. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you for the next one.
Until next time, let's keep questioning and striving for more honest impact.